So Dennis DeSilvis and Don Wallace, and this is item 12, open public input general. So Dennis?
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, Director Unsworth, Deputy Director Storr.
I'm Dennis DeSilvis, and I am a member of the WDFW's Wildlife Diversity Advisory Council, and also of the Tahoma Audubon Society Conservation Committee. I am not representing either of those organizations today. I want to be clear on that. Thank you. You have voiced many of the concerns I had related to the hunting and fishing marketing plan. I believe that broadening the spectrum of that plan, as has been mentioned, is paramount to ensuring the long-term viability of the department. When I looked, one of the things that it was, I read through the plan, and when I looked at it, on page 10 on here of this plan, they have a diagram. They're talking about population trends, and you see a population number, and you got a percentage and all that. Well, let me put this in perspective. 1,500 people a week are moving into the Seattle urban area. 1,500 a week. Think about that. That's a growing urban population that I believe should definitely be targeted in the more expanded marketing plan. You should do that. Labels mean something. I was a bit taken aback when I heard kind of like a sotto voce definition of loyal customer. In fact, what it seemed to me was that one needs to be a hunter or a fisher. Although I no longer hunt or fish, I consider myself to be a loyal customer of the WDFW. I have purchased personalized plates for up to 4 vehicles per year. And I have a Discover Pass, and since the inception of both of those programs, I suggest not using that particular label in a broader spectrum marketing plan without also expanding the definition. Again, thank you all for your concerns regarding the draft marketing plan. I heard that was very, very clear to me. Many of those reflect my own concerns, and I look forward to seeing the next iteration of the marketing plan. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dennis. And Ron, shy Ron once more. So, Don?
Hello again. I'm not going to talk about the banding this time. I'll talk about observation of the American Dipper. On Cornell's Birds of North America, their description of who builds the nest is pretty much says that the female does, that they are the dominant one when it comes to nests. I'm pretty certain that they do select the site, whether it's in the territory, but they are not the ones that build the nest. It's an equal time thing. And the example I have is a little story I'll tell you of the birds I've been watching the last several years. The female that had been there for the previous 3 seasons came back late. Her male had showed up in January and he left. He decided not to stay that year. When she came back, there had already been another couple come in and built a nest, and they were just about finished with it, and I'd predicted she was 5 days from laying eggs. When the female from the previous year showed up, and there became a territorial fight. And generally with dippers, whoever it is that comes into the territory, male or female, it's the male or female that goes after the same sex. So the female that came in immediately went after the other female, and the male would sit there and posture and flutter his wings and do stuff, you know, trying to defend his mate. But this female came, it was her territory, and she was not going to give it up. And these things can go on for days that they'll posture back and forth, you know, of just territory things, just whatever. They go back and forth. But this female had no way to deal with it. She was just going to take care of it. Within a few hours, and I was amazed I caught it on video, she went after the other female and attacked that thing and had it literally upside down in the water, pushing it, trying to look like it was trying to drown the female, and just beat the heck out of her. I mean, just, it was brutal. It just freaked me out. But anyway, so that female was gone. She left. She just was shattered. She went and hid for a while and then disappeared. And so the female, she immediately went over to the nest that was already there and started ripping it apart. And, you know, there was conversations going back between the male and this female. And so the female, she started her new nest, and she worked on it for 9 days. It normally takes about 2 weeks to build, for to prepare to build a nest. She had been working on it for 9 days by herself because the male just, he just wasn't into it yet. He wasn't, this wasn't his mate. He wasn't friendly with her at all, but he didn't leave. He was just there. So she's working on this diligently, and he's occasionally going to the old nest with moss and trying to fix it. And she would go back and destroy what he'd done. So eventually, after the 9th day, he finally got involved, and they both worked diligently together and got it done within a week, and then a week later they had babies. But I'm just, we're just showing that it's the observing, you know, they based what they said on their website by one person's 1 hour observation of what he saw in nest building. And I spent hundreds of hours watching them build nests. It's an equal time thing with partners as long as they get along. If they don't get along, one's going to spend most of the time doing it. If they're, once they're equal, they share in the responsibility. And it's.
Thanks, Tom.
That's it.
Okay. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Ray Brown and Ron.
This is one of the other issues I want to talk about today is hatchery production. Washington State thrives on salmon fishing. We have every kind of fishing going on here, but the bottom line is salmon fishing. It drives our economy. It's far larger than all our sport groups put together. It's a way of life for us. And it's really come into almost what is becoming a tragic ending. We are not seeing the returns of fish like we used to. PSA, we've gone out on our own. We've come in and we've brought the tribes, the commercials, and the recreationals. We're starting to band together, to work together, to try and fix some of these problems. And one of the things is we need to not demonize hatchery fish as they're demonized as the terrible thing. We live in one of the most complicated areas there is. As was said earlier, we have one of the hottest economies in the U.S. I'm in the building trade, I can tell you. You can't hire good people because everybody's busy. But how are we going to fix this? So we've started. ESA Salmon, this is one of the biggest issues we have, we're deemed with, are paid for at home waters here in Washington State, not in the high seas up north where they're harvested. The tribes, the non-tribal commercials, and us, the recreationals, have to pay for those impacts. They're harvested at high rates on the high seas in British Columbia and Alaska. 2 years ago, I believe it was, Alaska took 100,000 extra Chinook and didn't have to do any payback. And we pressed NOAA on this. If we were able to take as little as 20%, let 20% more of our fish get through back to us, we would have a heck of a lot better fisheries. And by the way, did everybody get one of these sheets?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. So I'm just going to hit on the high points. We've quit producing fish out of our hatcheries. 1989, we put out 23.3 million Chinook. 2016, 9.3 million. That's a 39.9%. That's all we're doing is 39.9% since 1989. Coho, 21.6 million in 1989, 5.6 million in 2016. That's only 26% of what we were. And this is down from previous years. 1989 was picked because it falls in between the Bolt decision, and also the ESA listed salmon. So it kind of gives, and plus it's a year that people can relate to. It's in their lifetime and not something so far back they can't relate. The HSRG, the way it's being run, the way our fisheries are run today, we have less wild fish than we ever have. It's bar none. We're not making hatchery fish. There's no buffer for the fish to get out. We have 20,000 sea lions where we can only support, 7,300 our seals, harbor seals. So I guess what I'm looking at, and on the bottom of the last page, there's a 23-year study from Idaho, a hatchery study that showed when we have higher productions of hatchery fish, the wild fish do better together. So I guess what I want to end up with is we've already paid for a person to go to Washington, D.C. and start promoting hatcheries. We've got some of the tribes on board. We plan on expanding this farther and farther. But I'm asking for the commission to possibly help us take a shot at this and start working towards hatchery production. What we've done is not working. It's very obvious. So it's time to change which way we're going. So if there's any way we could possibly assign a person to work with us and start going towards hatchery production, we already are in production of doing this, but it would help to have the commission on board with us.
Bellingham Technical College is producing the future hatchery managers.
Is that a yes?
At this point, we're going to take everything you say under great consideration.
Are you a politician? Thanks, Brad.
Yeah, thanks, Brad. And Ray, you know, and Al, speaking of sea lions.
Good afternoon, Commissioners, Director Unsworth. My name is Ray Brown. I have a message that you do not want to hear. I do not want to tell, but it has to be told. So here we are. My message is about sea lion predation, and the fact that sea lions are nuking salmon. Everybody knows it. It's the big white elephant in the room. Nobody wants to talk about it. For the last dozen or so years, I've lived out in Westport, very close to the Westport Marina and the airport out there. And I would hear them out there barking every night. And I'd see them out in the channel during the day out there where it narrows right there by Browns Point, and see them right along the buoy line there. And I'm an electrician by trade, so I deal with a lot of math. If you apply just some basic, simple math to this problem, you understand the scope of it, the magnitude of this problem. Sea lions can grow to 2,000 pounds. They eat 6 to 8% of their body weight every day. You take 6 to 8% of 2,000 pounds, it's about 150 pounds of salmon every day. Sea lions don't eat the whole salmon. They just take a few bites out of one, which, of course, destroys the rest of the salmon. So they wind up destroying a lot of salmon to get their food every day. We've had some success in predation. Jamie Herrera Butler's been doing some good work. Kathy McMorris Rogers been doing some good work. We win the argument with the public every time when they can see it on camera. When we can get a camera out there to the Bonneville Dam or to the Ballard Locks and they see how salmon are being mistreated by sea lions, we win that argument every time. The problem is we can't see what's going on out in the ocean. And it's my firm belief that the exact same thing is happening in the ocean. Just like at Bonneville Dam, the fish are schooled up all the time. Not just at the base of the dam, or at the locks. So they're easy pickings, even out in the wild. And a recent occurrence, I think, is giving us that virtual camera out into the ocean, and that is the death of orca whales in the Puget Sound area. They're dying of starvation from lack of Chinook salmon. I've had a marine biologist tell me that the orcas only eat Chinook salmon. 95% of their diet is Chinook salmon, and they're dying from starvation. They're currently at 76 units in the pod. They get below 70. We're talking extinction. So now we have that view of what's going on out in the wild. And I believe it's telling us that the ecosystem cannot support 300,000 sea lions. They were listed as endangered at 10,000. They've now grown to over 300,000, and they're growing exponentially. There's your problem.
Thank you, Ray. Yep. Problem it is. Al, you have the last word of the night.
Oh, wow. I go out in a blaze of glory here. Al Signal again, Steelhead Trail Club, and almost for a decade co-chair of the Steelhead and Cutthroat Advisory Group here for the state. And throughout all that time, we talked about steelhead and some about cutthroat. And now we're moving into a time period where we have an opportunity to streamline and simplify our regulations. Currently, sea run cutthroat in the saltwater are managed differently than they are in the freshwater. These are migrating fish, hydronomous. So in the saltwater, and I'm a sea run cutthroat fisherman, fly fisherman, catch and release guy. And in the saltwater, you can fish for sea run cutthroat, but with selective gear, barbless hooks, no bait, and you're not allowed to keep a sea run cutthroat in saltwater. When they go into the freshwater, they work under standard regulations, and you can fish for them with barbed hooks, tripled barbed hooks, spinners, bait, and you're getting them at their most vulnerable time, when they're entering, following the salmon, going through their spawning cycle. In talking with Larry Phillips and others in the department that have done some research, we don't have a lot of research on sea run cutthroat, but that the population, we think, is relatively stable. And about it's become kind of a niche fishery, and we're seeing more and more people that are fishing, particularly in the saltwater, for sea run cutthroat. And my suggestion to Steve, he's heard it a couple, three times or more, and it's in the minutes from many of our steel and cutthroat advisory group meetings, that why don't we make one regulation process the same for both the sea run cutthroat that when they're in the saltwater, and make it the same when they're in the freshwater. And it's the time to do it now that you have this simplification process going on. So that's my suggestion, and after years of talking about it, here's an opportunity to protect a fragile sea run cutthroat fishery. Thanks.
Thank you, Al.
That's good. Now, have you relayed that information to staff recently?
I relayed it to Steve Thiesfeld.
Recently?
Recently, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good. Well, thank you all. It was very informative, and we appreciate your input. So at this point, we will go into recess until tomorrow morning at 8:30. Thank you.